Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Tuesday, the 6th of May, we have a very busy first hour. First, a couple of announcements to make. We had a great finish to our very short and fruitful pledge drive. Thanks to all of you who contributed to Wisconsin Public Radio during our spring membership drive. You donated $149,000 over just a very short 3 days to help support the programming that you depend on. We had over 1,200 members pledged, and we're very pleased to welcome 342 new members to the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. So we thank you very, very much for your support. We have an extremely busy first hour today. First, let me tell you that, as you well know, the North Carolina and Indiana primaries are taking place today, and NPR is going to be providing special coverage tonight from 8 until 10 with coverage analysis. After 8, Michelle Norris and Melissa Block will be hosting special coverage of the primaries. And then after 9 tonight, Neil Conan will host a nationwide call-in, which should be great fun, on the day's events. And we are pleased to say that Melissa Block will be joining us the last part of this hour to talk about their special coverage. And one of the things, of course, that everybody will be looking at as people vote is the proposed gas tax suspension. And we are going to spend a good deal of time on that the first part of our program today. As you know, Senator Clinton and Senator McCain have proposed a suspension of the federal tax on gasoline for this summer. There are many economists who don't think that this is a great idea. McCain and Clinton suspending the 18.4 cents a gallon tax on gas. Clinton said that she would suspend the 24.4 cents a gallon tax on diesel this summer. Obama called McCain's proposal a bad idea and said any reduction in price at the pump would be short-lived. We have two guests with us this hour, Professor James Hamilton, professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego, who has said, "I don't think that a gas tax cut would result in a really big drop in gasoline prices. It's simple economics. Without a corresponding increase in supply, the price would rise again." Also joining us is Professor Christopher Knittel. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of California, Davis Department of Economics. And he says that taxes should be hiked by 50 cents or even a dollar to help fight global warming this summer and beyond. We'll be welcoming phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm sure we're going to have a lot of calls on this, so call in just as early as you would like. Professor James Hamilton, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
And Professor Christopher Knittel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's start with you, Professor Knittel. Not only are you saying that this is a bad idea, you think that taxes ought to go up. Why?
Well, while the prices at the pump are high, the prices still do not reflect all of the social costs that we incur when we burn a gallon of gas. This includes climate change, but it also includes the war in the Middle East, more local pollution, and many other factors. So from that perspective, the prices that we pay are actually too low.
Mm-hmm. So you would recommend even as high as a dollar increase?
A dollar increase would certainly be in the realm of possibilities. One thing that we should bear in mind that we're quite lucky in terms of our gas prices. If we go across the pond to Europe, many countries there are paying close to $9 a gallon.
Wow. What about people who don't have very much money?
Well, the beauty of a tax, or a carbon tax in this case, is it would generate funds. So if I had my if I could do what I wanted, I would increase the carbon tax, and I would give that money back disproportionately to low-income consumers who would be more affected by such a tax.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hamilton, you think that there wouldn't really be, if we had a big drop in gasoline prices, we would have to have a corresponding increase in supply. That doesn't look likely?
Well, that's right. I think if initially you might see, say, the full 18 cent a gallon decrease in the price of the pump, but the problem is that would increase the quantity that consumers want to buy. And the question is, where is that added supply going to come from? I think it most likely would come from imports. And the way we'd persuade those sellers of gasoline to sell to us rather than to their existing customers would be to offer them a higher price. And to the extent we do that, of course, that's eating away at the benefit that consumers are getting, and it's aggravating the geopolitical problems that Professor Knudel just mentioned in terms of giving even more money to the oil-producing countries and exacerbating our trade deficit.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to me as though this suspension is pretty short-lived, isn't it? It's only a few months.
Well, that's even a bigger problem, especially if it happened right away, because it takes some time to divert these resources. So it would take a number of weeks before you'd actually get the ships transporting added gasoline here to this country. And also, a short-lived spike to demand could result in a particularly impressive spike in the price. So I think we ought to be looking at the longer-term issue. I think there are some definite trends here that have been apparent for a number of years, and I think we ought to be focusing on those rather than just getting through this summer.
Mm-hmm. But Professor Knudel, Senator Clinton has said that she would pay for some of the lost revenue by imposing a windfall profits tax on oil companies.
Right. And in general, I'm not a big fan of windfall profit taxes for the very reason that it creates a disincentive for firms to actually go out and try to generate high profits. Although I will say in this case, with some of the oil companies enjoying $50 billion profits, it's probably not creating much of a disincentive. But there's certainly other places that we could increase our tax revenue from oil companies. For example, we still give them tax incentives for exploration, which makes no sense when oil prices are high, because gas or oil firms want to explore and find oil reserves just through the market. So there's certainly avenues in which we could raise more money from oil companies, but windfall taxes are in general a bad idea.
Would there be, as some economists have suggested, the side effect of cheaper gas would be increased demand for fuel, more people would be on the road, and it would put the prices right back where they started?
That's certainly possible, and actually even more likely in summer months when refining capacity is actually tight. When refining capacity is tight, it's difficult for suppliers to increase the supply of gasoline, which case the only mechanism of making supply and demand equal is to keep prices high. So it's certainly possible that we would either be padding the pockets of gasoline refiners or, as Professor Hamilton mentioned, Middle East oil producers.
Professor Hamilton, what about truckers? Diesel costs are really, really high. These guys and gals are hurting.
Well, yes, they are. And the basic issue is that we need to make some adjustments. As I was saying, I see this as a long-term development. It's been coming for a while, and it's going to continue to be with us for a while. And we need to make some changes in how we transport goods to market. And I don't think we can assume that we can always go on doing things just the way we have and that everybody has a right to do their business the way they did 10 years ago. When conditions change, we have to adapt and find the most efficient way to get the job done.
I was amazed to read the number of economists who were polled on this issue, and just a huge percentage said that it was a bad idea.
Well, that's right, and if we can go back to a point Professor Knudel was raising, any tax discourages whatever the activity is that you're taxing. You tax people for earning income, you potentially discourage work effort, and most of the time we don't want to discourage any of those things that could generate revenue. But in the case of gasoline consumption, I think we do want to discourage use. There's the issue of pollution, the greenhouse gases, traffic congestion, and these geopolitical issues from the wealth that we're creating abroad with our oil imports. So I think we do want to discourage consumption, and I agree with Professor Knudel, we don't want to discourage production. So to me, a gasoline tax is one of the least offensive taxes there is out there.
Mm-hmm. Do either of you see a significant change in the kinds of automobiles that we're driving? I remember not that long ago it was over half the American fleet were vans and SUVs. Has that changed substantially or not?
Yes, it has, and it's pretty dramatic. Mm. If you look at the April numbers, for example, the light truck sales domestically manufactured, which includes the SUVs, that's the biggest part of that category, are down 20% from last year. And April is the first month since I've been watching these numbers for the last 5 years where the number of cars sold in the U.S. significantly outnumbered the number of light trucks and SUVs. So we're definitely seeing a change there, and it's been hard to achieve that. I hate to see us try to undo that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and if I could just add, that's actually a topic of some of my current research, and not only are we seeing reductions in SUV and pickup sales and even minivan sales, but even within those categories, we're seeing shifts from the very low fuel economy SUVs to the higher fuel economy SUVs. So all of these factors are working towards increasing the fuel economy of our fleet. And as Professor Hamilton said, even though it's only 18 cents, getting rid of this tax is sending the wrong signal to consumers that basically the U.S. is going to try to keep gasoline prices low and not allow them to adjust with the market, which will undo some of these more beneficial effects.
Mm-hmm. Are you economists out of sync, though, with the American consumers? And when people go to vote today, they're going to be thinking not about all that you've said, but thinking about the fact that they're going to save money when they go to the gas pump.
Well, you know, they are going to save money, but they're not going to save much. The typical consumer will save about $30 for the 3 months that the gas tax will be suspended. So if Senators McCain and Clinton want to give the American public $30, I would much rather them just give them a check for $30 and not link it to the gasoline taxes.
Do you think that when people go to vote today, they're going to be voting in favor of a gas tax or not?
Well, I think politically, at least for Senator McCain, this was a great idea. It hits on two issues. One, he's lowering taxes, albeit very, very small, and he's capturing the American fears of high gas prices.
Well, but if this doesn't deliver, and I don't think it would, I think you'd have even more cynicism on the part of voters. And you know, the politicians think that they can manipulate people with these bumper sticker slogans, but I think on top of everything else, there's a lot of cynicism and distrust of our elected officials, and I don't think this helps that at all to be pandering in this way.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed that the federal gas tax has not moved since 1993. That's a long time ago.
Well, that's right, and again, it seems like one of the taxes that it would have made sense to be raising over this period.
Why wasn't it?
Well, it's not a popular political idea, as you were saying, to raise this tax. And, you know, anything you do institutionally has a lot of inertia. Whatever you set today, it's going to take some effort to change it. So any legislation like this, it tends to lag behind.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. We're talking about the gas tax, the proposed suspension of the federal tax on gasoline for the summer, been proposed by both Senator Clinton and Senator McCain, and will probably factor into today's elections primaries in North Carolina and Indiana. Professor James Hamilton is a professor of economics at the University of California, San Diego. Professor Christopher Knittel is associate professor of economics at the University of California, Davis, Department of Economics. Our phone lines are filled, but eventually you'll be able to get through. And if you want to send an email, you could do that as well. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our phone line is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later in this hour, Melissa Block will be joining us from All Things Considered. She is the co-host of special coverage of the results from the North Carolina and Indiana primaries, and there is a special tonight on our air from 8 until 10, 2 hours of election coverage. All right, let's go to phone calls for Professor James Hamilton, Professor Christopher Knittel. We start our calls with Diane from Milwaukee. Hi, Diane.
Hi, has Mrs. Clinton or Mr. McCain submitted a bill in the Senate to initiate this tax cut? You can talk about it all you want, but unless you pass legislation, it's just talk. That's all it is. And I haven't heard anything about a bill, especially if it's going to be for this summer.
Professor Knittle?
I'm not exactly sure if they have, but if I remember right, I think tax bills cannot originate in the Senate. They must originate in the House. So they would have to find a representative in the House to actually submit the bill. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't have any extra information on that either.
Chances are, though, if you looked at the Senate and the House, it probably an idea like this probably wouldn't pass. Am I right?
Let's just talk.
I doubt it would pass. I think it would be difficult to pass. I think the momentum against such a bill is certainly increasing.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Diane?
Well, if you don't have a bill, then it's just talk, and it's nothing else. It's just talk.
Thanks very much for your call. Louie from Wausau. Hi, Louie.
Hi. My modest proposal is that instead of our politicians, our leaders, instead of proposing handouts or government solutions, that they ask us to participate and conserve and, for example, ask us this summer to use 20 gallons of gas less. We'd save money and we would conserve. And then over the long run, use 2% less energy a year for 10 years, something like that. That would drive prices down. And, of course, we would save on the energy that we didn't buy.
Well,
so how about that?
I think that's a good point. I saw a study recently that some drivers could reduce their fuel usage by 30%, not driving any less, but driving a little bit more efficiently, keeping the speed down, not accelerating too quickly, keeping a good distance from the car in front of you so you don't use the brakes as much. Now, that's going to depend on your existing driving habits, but judging from some of the folks I see on the freeways out here in Southern California, I think there's a lot people could be doing for themselves to save themselves more money than the government could help us with this potential tax cut.
Yes, I think our history from 1980 to 2000 shows that we conserved during that period and prices stayed low.
30% is a lot for making those kinds of changes, isn't it?
Well, it depends on your existing driving habits. So
right.
That's the upper range, and it depends on what kind of driving you do and so on. But but anyway, for a number of people, there are some potential large savings available there.
Yeah. It is pretty astounding that we've had this problem and the price of gas keeps going up and up and we're dealing with the issue of global warming and there has been literally no substantial federal legislation to deal with all of this. It's dumbfounding to me.
Well, that's the upsetting part, at least for me, in this whole issue, is Senator Clinton was proposing what's called a cap-and-trade system to reduce our carbon emissions, and this just makes me question how much she actually would support such a legislation.
Tell me more about what that legislation is, cap-and-trade.
Well, what a cap-and-trade system does is it caps the economy-wide carbon dioxide emissions, and for every unit of carbon dioxide that a firm emits, it has to show that it owns a permit for that unit. And these permits are either auctioned by the federal government or given away to firms and traded among firms. So the price of those permits creates a disincentive for firms to emit carbon dioxide and increases the incentive for them to find ways to cut their greenhouse gas emissions.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much, Louis, for your call. We go next to Michael from Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you, Kathleen, for having these two wonderful guests. I enjoy listening to them talk, and I agree with them 100%. Unfortunately, this is a message that the majority of the Americans really don't want to hear. They're trying to tune it out. I think the American public can't get in touch with the reality of the fact that gas is going to be more expensive and they might have to actually change their driving habits and possibly what type of vehicle they purchase. I think this gas tax is just an absurd, stupid idea. But just because something is total or seems to be totally absurd to, I guess, a lot of us, just like the war that we're fighting, doesn't necessarily mean it isn't going to happen. And I've heard other guests talk about conservation and changing of driving habits. And that's something that the American public is never called upon to do, is to give up any kind of sacrifice, let's say, for paying for this war or for changing their driving habits in order to help solve the gas crisis. That's pretty much most of it.
Professor Hamilton, you want to start?
Well, that's right. That the politicians want to say, I guess, what they think the people want to hear. I saw one account that this proposal started within the McCain group, not with any of his economic advisors, but one of his pollsters somehow came up with the idea that this would resonate. And as I said a little earlier, I think our politicians may be miscalculating. I think if they really try to do what was in the long-term best interests of our country, I think, and or maybe I'm just hoping, that would eventually pay off for them. I think America is ready for a leader that takes that kind of perspective on things.
Mm-hmm. Professor Knill?
Well, I would agree 100% with the caller. I would go so far as to recommend that any wars in the Middle East are funded entirely from increases in gas taxes, just so that American people feel the burden from our decisions.
Thanks so much for your call, Michael. We go next to Craig from Onalaska. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. My comment is I own 5 vehicles, so I am constantly putting gas into those, gas or diesel.
What do you own? That's a lot of vehicles.
Well, I own a diesel pickup truck and 4 cars.
Huh.
So I'm constantly putting gasoline in or diesel into them. But I'm adamantly opposed to the reduction over the summer months of the gasoline tax. And the reason for that is I'm not going to save enough money to pay for any of those vehicles to be aligned if I hit a pothole. Hmm. And I think the gasoline tax is, you know, it's intended to repair our roads, build roads, et cetera, repair bridges. I'm sure those people in Minnesota, when that bridge collapsed, they certainly weren't thinking that it would have been a great deal to save $30. So I want safe roads. I want smooth roads, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my comment.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. And would a lot of this savings be diverted from keeping our roads in tip-top shape, gentlemen?
Well, the vast majority of the gas tax, so over 15 cents of that 18.4 cents, goes to the Highway Trust Fund, which does repair our roads. But these monies would come from somewhere, and as Senator Clinton is proposing, they would either come from a windfall tax or the general fund. So I doubt that those funds would go away, but it would certainly shift the burden of those funds from drivers to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Professor Hamilton?
Well, we certainly need the tax revenues. Nobody likes to pay the tax, but we can't really get along without the things we buy with it. So that comes back to an issue we've been talking about, that you need to raise revenues somehow, and there's some disadvantages from any mechanism you use, but let's pick the one that's the least of the available evils. And to me, a gasoline tax is a perfectly sensible and appropriate way to raise the revenue to, at a minimum, keep our roads safe and usable.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome more phone calls. I'll give you the number once again, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email is talk@wpr.org. And we're talking about the proposal by Senator Clinton and Senator McCain to suspend the federal tax on gasoline for the summer. Most economists, including our guests, say this is not a good idea. Professor James Hamilton, professor of economics at University of California, San Diego. Professor Christopher Knittel, associate professor of economics at the University of California, Davis. Our next caller is Gary from Madison. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I didn't hear the first part of your show, but it's very interesting. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I agree with your two guests and what they're saying. However, it occurs to me that it's a first-level analysis of a deeper problem that we have, and it's the manipulation of the dollar, and it's very low, so that drives up the barrel of oil. If I was producing oil and my dollar that I was getting was worth less, I'd be charging more. But in addition to that, the manipulation by the commodities market and the hedge funds that manipulate this on a weekly and monthly basis. And I'd like your guest to maybe talk about that, because I haven't heard that. And one last comment, and then I'll take my answer off the air. If you recall, right after the 2006 midterm elections, the price of regular gas dropped dramatically, and I believe it was around, I don't know, $2 a gallon. Well, that had nothing to do with supply and demand. That was some hedge funds overextending themselves in the commodities market, and that just seems to escape most discussions on the price of gasoline and other parts of this topic. Yes, I agree. Americans need to change their style, and we need different kinds of vehicles, like they do have in Europe. But it's this whole second level analysis with the low dollar and this the manipulation of the market. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call.
I would agree to a modest degree with the caller on this one, but I'd want to qualify it in terms of magnitudes and the time that we're talking about. So if you want to look just at the specific movements, say, in commodity prices since January, I think you can make an excellent case that the decline in the dollar is an important factor in that. Maybe about half of the increase you could account for from that. And I think you can also make a case that the very rapid reduction in interest rates by the Federal Reserve has encouraged some speculation in commodities and that that's made a contribution. But I think it's a mistake to think that that factor could explain the very long run trend that we're talking about, going back to 2000, the very substantial increase in the price of oil, for example, over that period, I think has very little to do with speculation or the dollar, and very much to do with the incredible growth in demand for the product coming out of Asia, particularly China and India. The growth there has been phenomenal. And that's just been eating up any potential production worldwide. And I think there's a tendency to kind of look for a simple explanation, and there's some truth certainly in what Gary was saying, as I say. But there's a bigger picture here, and I don't think we should ignore that.
We go to Jane from Sparta next. Hi, Jane.
Yes, good morning. Well, I am not an economist, nor am I a state or federal government employee, so I do not get my car and my gas paid for. I am 73 years old, and I have a small business, and I travel approximately 120 miles a day in this small business, working 9 hours a day. And it certainly would help me to have the benefit of a tax break on gasoline.
Okay. Professor Hamilton?
Well, I'm not disagreeing that if the price you paid for gasoline went down 18 cents, it would benefit you a great deal. One of the questions we're talking about, though, is whether that would happen. And I think there's a good case to be made that it wouldn't happen, that a lot of that 18-cent gain you might have enjoyed will instead be going, for example, to foreign producers, which isn't going to help you, it isn't going to help the government, it isn't going to help any of our basic problems here.
Well, I disagree with you on that. And I disagree with you because it's a proposal put out evidently by one of our candidates that is running for a place in our government that you disagree with, and that some others on the station here disagree with.
It's two of the candidates, Jane. It's McCain and Senator Clinton have both proposed this. So we've got a Republican and a Democrat who are proposing it. Well, Jane's gone. Thanks very much for the call. What about some other things? You talked about how our driving and if we drove different kinds of cars could make a difference. What about other things that all Americans should be doing right now that maybe we've overlooked that would lessen our reliance on oil?
Well, so as Professor Hamilton mentioned, our driving habits affect our gasoline use. Even such things as small as making sure that your tires on your car are filled up to the proper pressure can have large effects. And of course, if we can get consumers to shift more towards public transportation, that would reduce our dependency on oil and our gasoline consumption.
And that works well in some cities in this country, and in other cities, the mass transit system is not very good.
That's right. And ironically enough, about 3 cents of this tax goes towards mass transit funding. One proposal might be to, again, shift more tax funds or increase the gas tax to fund better public transportation to ease the burden of these high gas prices.
Mm-hmm. Bill from Madison, hi.
Hello. I'm really steamed about this whole issue because I'm in my late 50s. I've seen the gasoline prices rise over many decades. And when I was in high school in the 1960s, gasoline was about 35 cents a gallon.
That's hard to remember.
It's gone up by about a factor of 10 in that period of time, as has everything else. And so the price of gasoline, just going by the rate of inflation, really isn't that far out of line. Secondly, taking the gas taxes away is a terrible idea. I mean, I've been for a so-called first world G8 country, our infrastructure is a mess. And we need those taxes in order to repair the bridge that fell down in Minnesota, for example, to repair all the potholes in the interstate highway system. Compared to any other first world country, our infrastructure is an absolute disaster. And we need the money to pay for that. Some leader has to grow a spine and tell the American people that if you're going to have a first world civilized country, you can't have it at third world prices.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we've enjoyed a long stretch of really cheap gasoline prices, and compared to Europe, our gas prices are still low. Like I said, prices in Europe are close to $9 a gallon. And of course, they have now. It's not a perfect comparison because Europe's a fair bit more dense, but they have better public transportation systems. They drive more fuel-efficient cars. They drive fewer miles. All of those reduce their dependency on gasoline.
Thank you, Bill, very much for your call. We go to Marcus next. Hello, Marcus.
Hello.
Hi.
Very interesting story today. It hits me right in my pocketbook, literally. I drive semi for a living.
Oh.
But I'm kind of looking at things from a different perspective of why don't we forget about, not totally forget about the gas tax, but tax multi-vehicles. If, for example, a previous caller had 5 vehicles. Why does one person need 5 vehicles? Anything over 1 vehicle per person should be taxed. That would make people think about owning more than 1 vehicle, number one. And if every person had 1 vehicle, it would lower demand. It would lower wear and tear on our roads. It would lower the carbon emissions. I really see nothing bad from it. I mean, And I'll take my comment off.
Yeah, okay, but before you go away, Marcus, how hard are you being hit? You're driving a truck. You're paying a lot of money for diesel. What's it doing to your business?
Well, I myself, I'm a company driver.
Mm-hmm.
But my company has recently slowed my truck down. Semis have governors on them to keep your truck at below a certain speed. And they lowered my truck 3 miles an hour. They're talking about lowering it another 3 miles
really?
An hour.
Huh.
They are pulling us in for safety meetings to teach us different ways to get better fuel mileage. For example, progressive shifting. I'm sorry. It's all over it. I mean, with the slowdown of my truck, I'm going to see it in my pocketbook, in my paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, and I'm sure your economists will agree with me, is the fact of if you want to know what the economy is doing what's going to happen in the economy in 3 months, you need to look at look at what's going on with the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And because no matter what, everything that gets hauled goes on a truck.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much for your call. Professor Knill, you want to respond?
Well, so it's not so much the ownership of vehicles or the ownership of multiple vehicles that matters. It's how many miles you're driving them. And that's true for both the gasoline consumption, wear and tear on the roads. So a more direct way of getting at what the caller was suggesting is keeping the gas tax, because that's taxing actual fuel use as opposed to just taxing vehicle ownership.
Yes, if you had multiple cars, you actually have the luxury of choosing which vehicle to use for which task, and I could imagine somebody actually reducing their fuel use as a consequence of that. You know, you could think about, well, let's try to discourage the big cars or the fuel inefficient cars or various ideas, but ultimately what we want to do is reduce total fuel consumption and reduce the pressure the U.S. is putting on world oil prices through our use. And I think Professor Knittle has it exactly right. What we want to discourage is the use of gasoline itself.
We have time for one more phone call. It is Bob from Westfield. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
I think this gas tax freeze is ridiculous because it's not going to do a darn thing for anybody. I mean, gas goes up 15 cents a gallon every other week. The problem is, you know, our government has been sitting on their hands the last 35 years, and instead of going out there and exploring and getting the energy resources we have available right here in our country, they haven't done nothing. And, you know, of course, the radical environmentalists have stood in the way of that. Now we got this whole global warming nonsense in the way of that. And it's just been a problem. We should be looking for all means of self-sufficiency in energy. And, you know, and we're not. The other thing is, too, that it frustrates me to no end. Every time this issue comes up, someone says, well, in Europe, they're paying $9. Well, in Europe, they're paying that kind of money because three-quarters of it is taxed to pay for all their wonderful social programs they have over there. And this is something that the United States really doesn't need right now.
The president, of course, has called for Congress to allow more domestic energy production. Tapping oil in Alaska, building more refineries would help with high gas prices. He's uncommitted at the moment about the tax gas suspension. What do you think about the president's proposals in this regard, Professor Hamilton?
Well, certainly ANWR could help. The offshore oil could help. More refineries could help. But there's a long-run trend in the U.S. of declining production, and to attribute that to environmentalists or to a lack of effort, I think is just overlooking the basic facts, which are that we had some marvelous petroleum resources in Texas and Alaska, for example, but we're well into depletion with those, and there's really not much we can do geologically to stop that trend. I don't think it's a lack of effort. It's the fact that we developed the oil resources we had, and certainly the easily available ones.
Right, and even if we did open ANWR to oil drilling, the world oil market is just that. It's a world oil market, and relative to how many barrels of oil are traded in the world market, ANWR would be a drop in the bucket. So it would likely have a very small impact on world oil prices.
Gentlemen, we leave a full bank of phone lines holding, but we have to move on to the primaries. Thank you so much. We'll call you again because there is a phenomenal amount of interest in this, and rightfully so. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you for having me.
Our thanks to Professor James Hamilton, Professor of Economics at the University of California, San Diego, and Professor Christopher Knittle, Associate Professor of Economics at the University of California, Davis, talking about the proposed suspension of the federal tax on gasoline for this summer, which will probably play into the primaries in North Carolina and Indiana. And we'll ask our next guest how big a an issue that will be in those states. Joining us in just one moment, Melissa Block from All Things Considered, hosting special coverage of the primaries tonight. You will hear it on the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we've been telling you tonight, special coverage of the Indiana and North Carolina primaries from 8 until 10 on the Ideas Network. The coverage is from National Public Radio, and one of the co-hosts is Melissa Block, who is joining us now. And then after 9, Neil Conan will host a nationwide call-in on the day's events. That's tonight from 8 until 10. We're happy to have Melissa with us for a few minutes this hour to talk about their coverage. Melissa, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Nice to talk to you.
We were talking for the last 45 minutes about the gas tax. What do you think? Is that going to be primary on voters' minds in North Carolina and Indiana?
I think it's one of the issues. I mean, it certainly ties in with overall economic insecurity. You know, whether the gas tax and whether the candidate supported or not is a primary decision-making factor, I don't know. But it certainly taps into people's fears about their economic situation, their family's future. Looking ahead to a summer where gas prices are surely going to rise, it's a really potent issue, as you heard just now.
Yeah, it definitely is. And what about the other issues that will be moving people in both of those states today? Are they in any way different than, say, Pennsylvania or Ohio, Wisconsin, any of the other states?
You know, I think, you know, the message for Democrats this year, by and large, has been the economy is the issue. I mean, certainly the war
right.
in Iraq is there as well, and it depends, you know, obviously on people's experiences with that. But the economy, more and more, seems to be rising to the forefront, and you see all the candidates, you know, scrambling to address those concerns.
Mm-hmm. How do you prepare a special tonight? What's going to happen?
Well, polls close at 7 and 7:30, and we are committed to not obviously giving any results before polls close in the states. So we do a show from 4 to 6 Eastern that eliminates any mention of what's likely to happen tonight. And then once the polls close, we have our senior Washington editor, Ron Elving, who's in charge of deciding when we call a race for a state. And he has his own sort of formula for doing that. And then it's a matter of trying to break down what has happened, especially in a race that's this close with so many questions about delegates and who's ahead, and just, you know, trying to break down first the numbers in some comprehensible way, and then looking forward to what's to come with the primaries and caucuses still to happen, and ultimately the caucus.
So do you actually...
Excuse me, the convention this summer.
Right. Do you actually today, are you looking at various parts of North Carolina and Indiana and trying to figure what's likely to go Clinton, what's likely to go Obama, and you have a bellwether for determining how well the candidates are doing in those states?
You know, frankly, I don't try to break it down on a micro level like John King on CNN with his map, even though I'm very intrigued by his electoral map and how he can, you know, expand a screen. But no, I mean, I'm looking more broadly at, you know, how newspapers in those states are covering the race, what they see as important issues, what they see as trend lines. We'll be talking to people in those states through the evening to get a sense of, you know, what the turnout was, what constituencies were there. We always have Andy Kohut, the pollster, who is looking at exit polls and trying to see, you know, what's shifting. Mm-hmm. Are the trends that we saw, say, in Ohio going to be the same in Indiana or Pennsylvania or southern states? Will they be sort of, will North Carolina be following the pattern of southern states where Barack Obama did really well? So, you know, we draw on a lot of people who have been doing this for many, many years to try to parse through these results. And it's, you know, it's obviously been a fascinating election year.
Has it ever?
Yes.
And has it ever been a long one? Do you tire of it?
And there's more to go.
I know. There's a lot more to go. Do you tire of it at all or not?
You know, yes and no. I mean, I sort of came to work today thinking it's going to be a very long day.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
And haven't I asked all of these questions before? On the other hand, every state is different. And the longer it goes, I think, you know, it gets more and more intriguing in some ways as you see, you know, as you see sort of waves of support come and go and candidates maybe falter and then pick themselves back up. And then, obviously, it's still a long way till November.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to husband our resources a little bit and our energy.
Do you think that it will go all the way to the convention or not?
You know, I don't have a clear sense of that. I mean, I think a lot of things can happen in the next few weeks that could determine things one way or the other. But I think it's going to be interesting for a while.
Yeah.
We've certainly talked to people who said they do not anticipate a brokered convention, that they think, you know, people will, once a clearer result, you know, comes to the fore, that they'll sort of fall in line in one camp or another. And I don't have a sense of that. You know, it's, you know, some reporter's dream, I suppose, to have a convention that's completely up in the air because they can be extremely boring.
So, right.
There is some appetite for that, I think. But I don't know. I wouldn't claim to know.
So what do we need to get a clearer result, Melissa?
In terms of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and who's ahead?
Right.
Well, I think, you know, I think superdelegates would need to start drifting en masse to one or the other. I mean, I think what we've seen in the last few contests is, you know, a fairly straightforward breakdown, maybe one candidate doing far better in the popular vote, but the delegate breakdown, you know, comes out fairly evenly because of the way the Democrats apportion delegates. So you have this fairly narrow split, Hillary Clinton obviously behind. For her to come forward, you know, the math is complicated. She would need to start winning by very large margins and convince superdelegates to come to her in great numbers. And here's the big unknown, what happens with Florida and Michigan? Remember those states?
Right.
They were stripped of their delegates because they jumped to the front of the primary pack. The Democratic National Committee said, we're not going to seat you. And now there's, you know, they have to resolve that. What are they going to do with Florida and Michigan? Remember, Barack Obama wasn't even on the ballot in Michigan.
So who resolves that and when does that get resolved?
Oh, there are committees upon committees within the Democratic National Committee and the convention committees themselves. And it's extremely complicated. You remember they went round and around on this with the states trying to figure out, is there a way we can have a do-over? Is there a way we can run that primary again? And ultimately, they never came to an agreement.
Right. She's been getting a lot of attention lately as being this really strong fighter, this really tough woman who's not going to give it up, who's there again and again. A lot of commentators have said that. I don't know if it's because of the right deal that we've heard, heavens knows, a whole lot about, that he's off his game a little bit because of that. Hey, do you think that's true? Do you think that she's got the momentum right now?
I don't know about momentum. I mean, I think, you know, you see her signing boxing gloves.
Right,
and,
yeah.
You know, standing in the back of pickup trucks and stuff. I mean, I think they're trying to capitalize on that message that she is, you know, sort of, you know, on the offense. And I think Barack Obama would probably be the first to tell you that he has had to respond to some things that he would rather not have to respond to at this point in the campaign. But, you know, he draws huge crowds. I mean, no one is counting him out. No one is counting her out at this point. I think it's, you know, they are still both squarely in the fight.
But in order for her to win it, she would have to do what?
She has to win a lot. She would need to win, you know, large percentages of the popular vote to get pledged delegates in the numbers that she would need. And then on top of that, she needs a lot of superdelegates to come to her side. And even then, the math gets tricky. And that's where she would be counting on Florida and Michigan and some resolution of that would work in her favor. She's trying to make the argument, look, if you include Florida and Michigan, which is a big if, then I have won the popular vote. If you do the math and you add those votes in, then I, Hillary Clinton, have won the popular vote in all the contests so far. And she's trying to make the argument to superdelegates that if you couple that with the states that she has won, she hasn't won the most states, but look at the states that she has
right.
won, big industrial states that typically Democrats need to win in the fall, that she can make the argument to superdelegates that she is better positioned to take on John McCain.
Mm-hmm. How chaotic does it get for you tonight with all this information coming in from all of these different precincts and analysts and people you want to get on the air? It must be quite a sight to behold.
It's kind of a jumble. I mean, you'll get someone talking in your ear saying, okay, we have the governor, and then a second later, whoops, we lost the governor.
Ah!
So we're scrambling to find someone else. Look, compare it with Super Duper Tuesday when there were dozens of states. Two states doesn't seem so bad. I mean, you can sort of get a handle on that. I mean, Super Tuesday is insane when you're trying to keep track of that many states and who's going which way. And thankfully, thankfully for us anyway, polls close pretty early. So hopefully by the end of the night, we should have a pretty good sense. I mean, there have been other races where, you know, kind of counting went on so long and polls closed late that you didn't really get a sense of where things stood. And then remember Texas, where they have that primary and a caucus, and
right.
It was counted for weeks, and no one knew who had won the caucus, what the numbers were in the caucus.
Right.
So, you know, it is chaotic, but it is a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm sure.
We try to keep the chaos off the air.
I think it's great that Neil's doing this national call-in show, too. It's one of those shows that you'll want to hear what everybody has to say.
Yeah, it sure is, because there's so much attention on this race, obviously, and so many people's concerns that, you know, frankly, we may not get to in the course of our broadcast when we're talking to analysts and thinkers. And obviously, it's great to hear from voters and what's on their minds. It can be very much at odds with what we have said probably in the previous hours.
Yeah.
You know, the exit polls give you some sense, but I think, you know, people who call in give you a, as you know from your show,
right.
Give you a really, really clear picture of what's right. On people's minds.
Yeah. Melissa, thank you so much. We'll look forward to hearing you tonight.
You bet.
Melissa Block, she's co-hosting special coverage of the primaries tonight, and you will hear it on the Ideas Network. It's tonight from 8 until 10, and Melissa and Michelle Norris will be co-hosting, and then Neil Conan will have this national call-in show following, which should be extremely interesting. We, of course, will be covering the race tomorrow at 9 o'clock to look at the results. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production in our studios. We'll return.